Recording.
I think I'm gonna work okay. I reinstalled my Zoom, so we'll see if
Yeah,
it.
we missed you last week. There's a lot of I
Well, I
guess
kept dropping out, so
QSB on your end, right?
yes.
Yeah.
So, welcome to the March 2nd, 2021 session of Tangerine SDR and Ham Psi Technical Personal Space Weather Station Technical Talk. So I'm Dave, KV0S, and this week I've been working on the programming simulator, and I've at least got both ends talking as simulations, so at least in protocol one. And I have some questions for Bill and Tom a little later, but things are moving forward, so that sounds good. And that's about it for me. Next on the list, we have Nathaniel, W2NAF. Go ahead, Nathaniel.
Thanks, Dave. It's been a very busy week for me. I've been working on getting the HamSci workshop moving along. I've emailed almost everyone who will be presenting at the workshop so they know that. I am working on getting the iPosters set up. The contract is in place, so I'm going to email them the contact information for the people who've responded back to me tonight. So hopefully by tomorrow, people can start building up their iPosters. I've got the registration link is up on the website. So if you go to hamsci.org and you go to the workshop page, you can now register to participate in the HamSci workshop. Note that if you are presenting, you don't need to register because I will send you a special panelist link that you will be able to participate as a panelist if you are one of the presenters. Let's see, the other big thing is we had Jay Silber from he is the PIO for the Eastern PA section of the ARRL. He did a special on the GREIP Personal Space Weather Station that premiered on YouTube last night. And so there's a link in the chat about that. And so I'm in the video. Frankie Bonte's in the video. John Gibbons is in the video. This is a very nice video. And then finally, Bill Engelke, Phil Erickson, and I have been working on a NASA proposal to look at traveling ionospheric disturbances in RBN Whisper and PSK reporter data, and we got it submitted today. So it's been a big week.
Yay.
So that's all.
Very good. Well, next on the list, we have Dan in for XWE. Go ahead, Dan.
Okay. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. I got the difficulties with my script for the new radio sorted out. And thanks to some comments by Tom McDermott, I started thinking in the right direction. And after I started thinking in the right direction, everything fell into place and it works very well. So learned a lot last week and looking forward to next week. And I see Bob McGuire just showed up. My heavens. Hi, Bob. Okay, back to you, Dave.
Well, fine business. Next on the list, we have Bill, AB4EJ. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, thanks, Dave. Good evening to you and a good evening to the net. As Nathaniel mentioned, we worked with him a little bit on getting the NASA proposal put together. Also, I've been working a little bit on getting a pie hat with a GPS chip on it, working on the GREIP so that it could know the time of day and know its location and some things like that. And in working on that, I managed to mess up the rest of my system to where the new radio wouldn't even work. Okay, I mean, I've got it to where I can show the serial input and the data coming from the GPS chip card. The Pi Hat is just fine, and I've got software that can parse it and convert it to a Unix time, which you need for digital RF. But then somehow I managed to trash GNU Radio, so then I used Dan's script But I should say, Dan, the new script worked fine, but it still didn't solve my problem. It ran through without any problems, but when I try and run GNU Radio, it starts, well, it seems like it's starting, and it consumes 1% of CPU time, but the user interface never shows up, and you see it there, and there's a process running that's taking a little bit of CPU time here and there, so I'm thinking, oh man, what did I screw up? So I'm starting to think to myself, do I have to rebuild the whole system to get back? Anyway, so we're making some progress. So we will have something, once we get past that, we will have something for the Antarctica project, barring any real unforeseen circumstances, where it'll be able to know where it's at, assuming you can get a GPS fix. The first Pi Hat they sent me, the antenna connector fell off. It wasn't even there. And so I had to get a replacement, Anyway, so making some progress, but, you know, like these projects always are, very slow and difficult. So anyway, back to Ned.
Well, fine business, Bill. And I know those weeks happen. So anyway, next on the list, we have Bob in 4HY. Welcome, Bob. Bob, we'd like a comment.
Yeah, so, sorry, Ed, the net froze. So I'm interested in Tangerine SDR because I'm trying to build an Ionosonde out at Kentland Farms, which Nathaniel knows well. And we've now have access to high speed connectivity out to Kentland Farms, so we can build quite the instrument out there. And as Nathaniel knows, and maybe many of the rest of you know, Virginia Tech has quite the group of ionospheric research scientists, and I'm looking at Tangerine SDR as a potential component for that. I have Red Pitaya. I'd rather use Tangerine SDR. So just for everyone's information, I'm now on the board of ARDC, and ARDC is very, very proud to be supportive of the Tangerine SDR, and we are looking forward to all it can do and see how it grows and all the things that it will enable going forward, and I'm very happy to be here. I will be here more often now.
Go Hokies!
So, nice to see you, Bob.
Thank you, Bob. I appreciate that. And welcome to the list. So, next on the list, we have Dave, KDE0EAG. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello. Nothing to report. Nothing I want to report at this time. So, back over to you.
Fine business. And next on the list, we have David, N1HAC. Go ahead, David.
Good evening, everyone. I continue to work with VLF stuff and preparations for our Viper sounding rocket, which is a VLF propagation mission flying from Wallops. We're currently scheduled for the middle of May. We'll see if it happens. Back to Net.
Fine business. And then next on the list, we have Gary, AF8A. Go ahead, Gary.
Yeah, good evening, everyone. Just copying all the traffic and trying to stay current. Back to Net.
Fine business. Next on the list, we have Homan, KD2MCR. Go ahead, Homan.
Good evening, everyone. Yeah, I've been nothing really specific to report other than I've been working on some science aspect of the magnetometer applications. I'm trying to work with my colleagues who is calculating the level of currents around the Earth using the array of magnetometers and trying to prepare for abstract and title for HAMSCI workshop as requested by Nathaniel. So other than that, yep, that's all I have to say. Back to Net.
So I have a question for you, Nathaniel or Holman. Have either of you heard from Jen about the access to their magnetometers?
I haven't heard.
Okay. I haven't either. So I just wanted to make sure we're on the same page.
You mean Jennifer, right?
Yeah, Jennifer.
Gannon.
Daniel. Yep.
She nominally allowed Dave and I to use the one here in Columbia. There is a magnetometer that she control. Is it DAST? Her project, NSF project,
Daisy
has
project?
One here. Huh?
Her Daisy project?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she offered that, but they haven't told us when the site was available. They said sometime mid-February.
Yeah, I haven't heard. I haven't seen anything come across my email.
Okay.
So I'm supposedly on a list, but I haven't followed up on it. And I can't say I was, you know, really closely looking for it. But yeah. I don't remember it coming across my email.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure I didn't miss something there.
Yeah,
anyway.
Speaking of that, related to that, I was wondering if anyone's checked magnetometers today. We had a pretty good geomagnetic storm overnight.
Yes, my whisper got a lot of good spots last night. So
I haven't plotted my data yet, but I will.
So next on the list is James, KG4DSG. Go ahead, James.
Yeah, I'm here just listening in, checking what's going on, and turn it back to the net, KG4DSG.
Oh, okay. Next on the list, we have Jim, 7J1AJH. Go ahead, Jim.
Good morning. Just listening. Thanks.
Okay. And then next on the list is another Jim, K4BSE. Go ahead, Jim Farmer.
I think I needed to unmute myself. Sorry. I had gotten a little bit concerned listening to the conversations about logging WWV at the South Pole. And so I had gotten kind of curious about what stations might be on the same frequency. So I made myself a spreadsheet that I've spent a little bit of time on of all the stations I could find worldwide that were on. I went from 2.5 to 25 megahertz to see how many stations might be QRMing those WWV frequencies. There are a lot of stations on 5, 10, and 15 around the world. I've sent that spreadsheet to Christina. I don't know whether she's done anything with it or not. I think she had some people looking at that issue too. So I don't know anything about that. But there are a lot of stations to listen through for WWV. I've downloaded VoiceCap now, and I'm going to see if I can play with that a little bit and see if I can get some propagation guesstimates off of that. But it's going to be interesting.
Very good. And next on the list is Joe W7LUX. Go ahead, Joe.
No, thank you, Dave. Again, good evening, everybody. I've been spending a fair amount of the week between a couple of projects. One, we've got mountaintop repeaters that need work. And the other one is trying to learn more about this ham psi project, including the tangerine. And been right now I've got a 10 meg oscillator feeding a spectrum analyzer, trying to figure out how far down I can see, and not very far. Anyway, that's what I've been up to. So appreciate hearing what everyone else is doing. Thank you.
Well, fine business. And next on the list is John N8OBJ. Go ahead, John.
Good evening, everybody. Last week, I pretty much disappeared. Had some personal family business to attend to. And I'm digging myself out of emails right now. I did see some activity concerning making the Grape One a kit. I haven't talked to anybody about that yet, but I took the impetus this afternoon. I created a parts list with all the DigiKey part numbers included with it to build one and put the schematic, the board layout, and everything up on the PSWS documentation directory under the Grape Gen 1 stuff. So it's all up there if someone wants to do that. I guess the only thing I ask is they don't change layout or anything on that, but we'll get into that later. Also, I've just had some correspondence with Pete and Gareth about installing the Grape 1 station at their place. I'm going to have a meeting with them tomorrow night to help them hook it up and get that working. So nothing else going on. Back to that.
Well, fine business. That sounds like you did a lot, even though you were sidetracked for a while. So next on the list is Jonathan, KC3EEY. Jonathan, is your new job working out?
Hi, everybody. It's been pretty fun. It's kind of slow to start. I'm reading a lot of documentation, but I'm slowly learning about what I'll be working on and also about government work. It seems to be it's completely different than I've ever experienced. So that's really cool. I don't have anything to report other than I was wondering if this is a question for Scotty, if he was able to figure out what voltages are available for the master clock for the module, because I need 1.8 volts since he has 1.8 volt IOs. And I was wondering if you figure that out, maybe that'll be for general or after discussion. That's all I have. Back to the net.
Well, fine business. And next on the list, we have Jules, K2KGJ. Go ahead, Jules.
Okay, thanks, Dave. A few things this week. Last week I missed due to some snow clearing operations here at the same time. Nathaniel had asked me if I had some recent information on Antarctic propagation from pole. I happen to have a couple of SJT FT8 logs that pole station recorded in a 24-hour run on 40 and 20 a couple of years ago during our summer, or late fall, or early fall rather, for a contact that we were planning out of K1TTT here nearby. And I forwarded those to Nathaniel, which has some interesting stuff, including signal levels from various parts of the U.S. and various parts of the world. The other thing this week that I worked on was measuring timing on an I2C multiplexer that Dave Whitten and I have been looking at, and found that it's an 8-port I2C multiplexer. Each port would handle up to 4 magnetometers if we decided to do that. And found that it adds very, very little overhead at all, enables us to essentially scan at whatever speed we want. Other than that, back to net.
Fine business. Next on the list is Michael, AAAK. Go ahead, Michael. Very good. And next we have KJ6MKI, listed as monitor only. I don't know if they want to say anything or not. I guess not. So next on the list is Rob Robinette. Go ahead, Rob.
Hi, hello everyone. I'm driving, so I'll keep it brief, but I just thought I'd listen and make sure I'm up to date. I'm doing the same stuff. I'm doing major revision on my Whisper Demon program. One of the primary goals is to start to add support for the new FSE4W Whisper modes that were introduced in JTX 2.3. And among those, in addition to about almost 2 dB improvement in sensitivity, use of those modes are some longer packet lengths. So they've introduced 15-minute, 30-minute long packets, which the effect of which is to increase the sensitivity by 10 or 12 dB or more over current whisper packets. Of course, you have to have a very stable signal. You can't have Doppler in those during those transmissions. So anyway, there aren't many people using it, but hopefully when all of my clients, you know, or most of the top spotters, top 10 to 20 spotters are all running my software. So once we do that, hopefully we'll see these new whisper modes and maybe learn about propagation events that heretofore have been not observed. Just because, you know, our sensitivity levels now will be significantly greater. We'll see how many people are actually using it, though, and I think there's a chicken and the egg thing with whisper, 30-minute whisper, whisper 1,800 seconds is, I guess, the term. But once we have listeners, hopefully there'll be more transmitters and, you know, more whisper events, maybe over, we'll see propagation events that weren't previously observed. Anyway, that's my area of interest and activity right now. Back to that.
Very good. And next on the list, we have Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Dave. And lots of progress made this week. Did a prep and a talk at West Central Florida Tech Con on the Tangerine. So that was kind of fun. It was about a 50-minute talk and maybe help get the word out. They put the videos up on YouTube. So if you want to search for WCFTECHCON, West Central Florida Tech Con, it's a section event that they have every year. And it was kind of patterned after the Tapper DCC, a little mini version of it. So did that. And I sent some boards off to Jules. I hope he got them. You have to kind of keep track of stuff like this because deliveries with the weather have been not so good. Lots of progress on the data engine. We actually have a clean read-in. The CAD guy has a clean read-in of all the PCB decals on the board. So we've got them all built. And since the last time through, I found two errors in the decals. I went through and checked every single one again, just to make sure I didn't lose anything. Didn't find any additional errors, but now I have better confidence that we're not going to have a problem with having a pin swapped or something. Also completed the Quartus project with all the pins listed and have gone into the Quartus tool and assigned the pins to the pins that I have on the schematic to verify that in fact it will let us build an FPGA that will have the same pinout as what I have on the board. Found some problems, so I had to spend today switching some data buses around to make sure that we had pins that had the right IO voltages and the right IO characteristics that we're allowed to set in the Quartus tool so that we can get an FPGA that's actually going to work. The next, incidentally, this project we're going to use for, Dave and I are going to use this for building the initial loader, the bootloader and the programmability, so you don't have to load all the Quartus software to update. Because I envision there's going to be lots of updates here coming out as we get hardware. And it'll be very nice to not have to load a huge, cumbersome program to be able to upgrade your software, your firmware in the FPGA. Didn't get to do it today. Was supposed to have a telecon with the CAD guy today. And I'm guessing by next week, we're going to have a placement for the data engine. And we'll be able to check the fit of the RF module, which of course is completed already. And so that's going to be pretty exciting because I'll have something to actually show concrete, to actually show a board with where the parts are going to be. Jules, do we need to build you a little motherboard so you can put like 8 magnetometers on one board? You seem to be wanting lots of them. So
no, that's all right. I've got a double-sided PC board set up for that. And I I also sent you a note on the chat that I did receive the parts today. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks. I'm thinking of an octomagnetometer. Anyway.
Well, you know, a couple of people have been interested in the rays, Dave and Hellman, and we thought we'd at least test this multiplexer, which again, really adds extremely small overhead to the switching time and doesn't, once you've switched ports, which it doesn't slow down the bus at all.
So I take it then you can actually take this multiplexer and hook 8 of the multiplexers that you already have up to it without having to redo anything, right? Is that right? That's
correct.
Oh, that's going to be awesome. Okay. Anyway, that's all I have, Dave. Back to you.
Well, fine business. And next on the list should be Tom, N5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening, Dave. Hi to everybody on the group. A little bit of work. I also gave a presentation at the WCF TechCon, the very basics of GNU Radio. It was interesting. The installer GNU Radio got a forced undesired upgrade the day before due to repository renaming of GNU Radio. So I managed to wind that back and got that fixed in time for the demo. And I've had a bunch of off-list Q&A with Dan and a few others on some other ideas. Back to the group.
Well, fine business. And I believe that is the list. Has anybody been missed? Well, if not, we're open for general discussion.
So, Tom, how did you get many questions on GNU Radio?
I've got a few. The Q&A probably lasted 6 or 7 minutes.
Sounds good. Sounds like there's some interest.
Yeah, I haven't looked at the video yet, so I guess they put one up.
All right.
Yeah, it shows a video of the whole thing and then individual talks as PDFs.
Okay.
So I had a couple things I wanted to ask about tonight. One, I wanted to know from Jules and Dave Witten and Human, I talked about it a little bit on email, but I was wondering, I was thinking for the HAMSA workshop of splitting the magnetometer talk into two parts, a science and a hardware part. And I think Human's going to take care of the science part. I was wondering if, you know, if either Jules or Dave wanted to lead the part on the hardware.
Sure. There's a software part to this as well.
Yeah.
But did you want to split that out as well?
Well, whatever you think is an appropriate update, because I guess, so what I'm looking for is an update from like what's happened since Tapper DCC. So okay, well, as far as I know, there's a lot of stuff that's been going on. There's been software developed. There's been, you've come up with that nice PVC pipe holder for these devices. I know you've also been doing a lot of testing. So I think all of those would be really good to hear about.
Okay, why don't I get together with Dave and we'll work that out.
Okay, that sounds really good. So tentatively, in a minute, I can tell you tentatively what time I have you down for doing that. It'll be on Friday, the 19th.
Okay.
It's going to be in the morning. It's around like 10:40 or something like that. I can give you the exact time in a couple minutes.
Good.
Thanks. And then the other thing I wanted to ask about was John Gibbons. Thank you very much for considering doing that kitting. The problem... it's a really good problem we have. So Christina Collins led the authoring of this really nice EOS article that went out to AGU through the American Geophysical Union about the Personal Space Weather Project and HAMSI in general. And so we've gotten a lot of really good press from that. And now this Eastern PA video just came out too. And so now I'm getting emails all the time. They're like, when can I get something? When can I get something? And I think we are still We have some grape hardware that is, you know, out there, but there's no way that we can really fulfill every single order. So I guess my hope was maybe we could, even if we can't provide these things for people, maybe we could make the plans available or make it available so that they could order the parts and put it together themselves. And so that's, I was wondering what the feasibility of that is.
Yeah, I finished up the parts list this afternoon, and that's the complete part list. The boards I had ordered through OSH Park, they're 0.88 inches by 1.5 inches. I think it's $6.60 shipped for three boards. The most expensive parts on that entire thing are the two SMA edge mount connectors. They're like $5 a piece.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole rest of everything else is all, you know, pocket change stuff, you know, nickel and dime stuff. So I haven't done a total sum, but I have a feeling it comes into something under $20 or $25 for everything. There is one other thing I can do, is that I could panelize the boards such that when you order one board, you get like 50 of them.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody wants to distribute them.
Yeah.
So that's what we got to talk about, but it's doable. I've done that already.
Yeah.
It's a couple hours.
Is it something that Tapper could help out with?
I don't know. That's what we have to talk about.
Okay.
Right now, the board is up on OSH Park. I could make it public and anybody could order it. The parts list is up in the directory with the schematic. The board layout, everything is up on the PSWS documentation GitHub site now.
Would this make a better fit for somebody stepping forward and doing a group buy? Or would it be better to have Tapper buy all the parts and sell a kit?
I'm thinking the former. I don't know what, I mean, the parts are really, you know, 0.1 bypass caps, hemite, ceramics, and a few other things. So it's nothing special. Either way, it could be done. But I think we need to sit down and talk about it, just figure out what we need to do. I think it would work either way.
Especially if it's a really inexpensive bunch of parts.
Yeah.
It would really make sense to be able to buy the whole kit, because then you're amortizing shipping over a lot of parts instead of just everybody paying $10, which is twice the parts cost.
My new bill of materials has all of the parts coming from DigiKey, and the part numbers from DigiKey are in there and the quantities are there. So it's one page, boom, you're done.
Because we can certainly buy the parts from Tapper, but we need to get a volunteer to do the kitting.
That's the issue.
But I think that's doable.
Is that people have to put on surface mount components that are very small. I mean, that's it might be a lot easier for people to build the boards and provide the board as a kit. Just saying.
Well, the smallest part on there is an 0805 in terms of R's and C's and L's. There is a SOT 23 5-pin regulator on there. There's a standard 8-pin SOIC for the op amp, or so the mixer. The op amp is a 6-pin SC73 or SOT 23 6-pin. The smallest part is actually the protection diode. And there's a trick you can play to putting that on, but it is itsy bitsy. So
smaller than the SOT 23.
What's that?
Smaller than a SOT 23 or an SOD part?
No, it's insanely small. But there's a trick for putting it on. You put a solder blob on a thing, you slide it in, it grabs the one pin, you solder blob the other side, you're done. So I figured out how to do it, but for somebody who's not well versed in soldering, it could be a problem.
Well, so Nathaniel, what do you think is the take on this? How many are people going to want?
I don't know. I've gotten about a handful of emails so far. And I guess what I'm worried about is that now that we're kind of, whether we like it or not, we're out there. People know about us and people want this thing, even if it just does like a bare minimum.
I also have to provide the image for the Raspberry Pi, which I've now got compressed and ready to go.
Yeah.
So that, you know, that comes up and FLDigi is running with my program. Everything's flying. So it's ready to go.
That's really the two criteria is you need to build a, between really below 100. It's not really worthwhile having it manufactured.
And
if you're going to build 20, 30, then we'll get a volunteer to cut the tape and mark it. And
I think that's the route. If we could get a volunteer to do, you know, 20, 30, maybe 50, like just enough to kind of appease these people who are like just chomping at the bit to get at something.
But then because they'll have to build it.
What?
You'll have to build it.
And you know, that's okay. Because what we want to tell them is we're like, look, this is a development project. We're you know, working as a community. We're like, this is what's available right now. And because John is, we don't want the world flooded with grape version ones.
Right.
We want the world flooded with grape version twos and tangerines.
Well, do I want to support the world so flooded with grape?
Right. But at the same time, I don't want to get this reputation of like, oh, we're just vaporware. We don't have anything, or you can't get anything. Because now Becky wants to run a basically a version of Christina's article in QST in August. So like, once it hits QST, people are really going to want this.
Well,
so like
you know that Tapper has a running ad in QEX that probably has some piece of hardware still in it that we don't even make anymore.
Nobody Scotty.
Well, that's not possible. No.
So that will be a good time to update the ad to show this new thing. But once you do that, a QST article, you better be ready for support because you're going to get 5 or 10 people. You're going to get lots.
So that. Maybe one for thing the about first that. Development, there's somebody here on the list that would like to do this.
Yeah.
I don't see anybody jumping ahead, but they should contact either Scotty or Nathaniel if they have an interest.
Because I'll send it off to our CM and have them built, but you're going to need to build 100. If you're going to build 10 or 20, it's not worth it.
See, I think when we get to when the grape version 2 is ready, that's what I'd like to do. Yeah. But like for right now, I just want a stopgap, even if it is just like, okay, look, grape version 2 is coming. For now, you want this, go to OSH Park, you know.
Make it harder.
Well,
make
that's
it harder, right?
So, I think that's what you want to do is make it OSH Park with a bomb. And a board, and they have to build it themselves.
Yeah.
And
it's
it's
not that hard. Those are parts that are not that hard to make if someone knows anything of what they're doing.
And then we're at least appeasing the people who want to be early adopters.
Yeah.
And we're also saying, look, you know, this is a community project. We're not a company trying to like sell lots of these things, you know, for whatever reason. Like we're a research project. And so now you can be part of it. And here's how you do it.
What we need to warn them about is that we have to buy a Raspberry Pi 4 with a case and a fan.
Yes.
You have to buy a Leo Bodnar unit for $140.
Yes.
Or have the equivalent
offer from us. You know, I mean, there's a lot of logistic types of things that, you know, if they see the article, oh, you know, $20, I got this station. Then they realize they have to spend another $200 to get everything they need.
Are you using what frequency are you getting out of the Bodnar unit?
I'm able to do 2.5, 5, 10, and 3.
Oh, so you're creating the
I have software on the Pi that actually goes out and reprograms the Bodnar directly.
Yeah, but you're doing the local oscillator?
Yes.
Got it.
We're at kilohertz below the beacon frequency. So
right.
I can program 2.499, 4.999, 7.849, or whatever it is, just for V3 and 7.
So you're relying on the Bodnar for that.
Yeah.
Though, of course,
filters are set up for 2.5, 5, and 10 megahertz.
Which I did just notice that there, you know, there's some problem getting the Silicon Labs part that everybody uses. That's gone in short supply, but you could use one of those units and a more general.
But aren't you going to use the Bodnar GPS for the Mark II?
Nope. John Ackerman's designing the GPS board for us that I'm using.
You're going to use the clock module then for that?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
I like that approach.
Yeah. I'm just thinking if you're going to use the Bodnar for the Mark II, then you might encourage more people to buy the Bodnar. But now yeah, you say, well, that'll be something else. And you know,
he will not give me the one PPS directly, and he will also not give me the timestamp. And he won't give me the GPS coordinates. I mean, it's all he's spitting it out, and I could reverse engineer it, but I don't want to do that because we're really not going to be relying on it. And what John Ackerman has, he can give me the one PPS, he can give me the four frequencies I'm looking for, and the 8 kilohertz sample clock.
How close are we to having John Ackerman's
the
unit running?
It's going to follow right on the heels of the data engine. Its schematic is pretty much done. The design for manufacturing info, I have to go through and do that, but I'm spearheading the data engine right now, and it's already so far behind, I'm not going to push it out anymore. But we do have to get the clock module, at least the layout, done before we can proceed on the data engine because it plugs into the data engine. So we have to make sure everything's going
to
fit.
Yeah, I got to talk to John about that too because I need direct access to be able to get the either the NEMA stream or whatever so I can make my Raspberry Pi be the Stratum 1 time source.
Talk to me because we have worked out the IOs. So okay. they're already done. So let's make sure you're covered.
Okay, we'll talk.
Okay.
So I know John. Yeah. So John, back to like quote unquote kidding this out, what about the possibility of just writing up a single page that I can point people to that say, how do I get one of these? I can go click here and it has the links to the OSH thing as all the stuff that it's essentially self-supporting. So
I could write that up. It's a couple hours work, but I can do that.
Can't you put a bomb up on DigiKey so you can go click and it orders all the parts?
Oh. I've never done
yes,
that.
Yes, you can.
Projects.
Yes, you can.
Okay.
That'd be nice because I'd love to just have a thing that says, okay, yeah, we don't have it made yet, but here, go to this page. Here are all the instructions you need. You can build one yourself.
So what you're saying is you want a fairly high hurdle. You don't want it so easy that anybody and their brother is going to try it, but the people that are serious about it can make that hurdle.
That's right. And that way, the people that are serious and really want to do something, they can do something.
And that will identify them to us also.
Yes. Hopefully they'll come and work with us.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's part of what I would tell them. I'd be like, look, you know, this is a community effort for designing these things. And so, you know, part of the amateur radio is this tradition of building things. So now you can go build it and.
Well, hopefully it builds enthusiasm for the Mark II that will come out and be much easier to put together.
Yes. Yeah.
How much is the Bodnar? Is he asking for his unit nowadays?
It's about $140 bucks.
120.
140 in single quantity.
Oh, okay.
You need the dual output one, or can you use the single output one?
You use the single output one.
So you can use the cheaper one then.
Yeah.
With shipping, it costs me $145.
That sounds about right.
Okay.
So should we put together kind of like a marketing poop sheet that would describe what we're talking about here so that maybe we could review it amongst ourselves and say, hey, is this something we want to put out there and use that as kind of a starting point?
It'd be a good review for me. I would appreciate that.
Well, AF80, I'll volunteer to help you with that, John, because it makes a lot of sense.
If you want help setting up the BOM on DigiKey, our buyer here is well-versed at DigiKey. You could set that up, and then you could just use it.
Okay, I will get a hold of you and talk to you about that, because I spent 2 hours this afternoon going through my order lists and populated all the DigiKey part numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's up on the website now, if you want to go up and look at the schematics there, the block diagram is there, the full board layout is there, everything. Parts list with DigiKey part numbers. So that's pretty much covered. The OSH link is going to be easy to do because I just have to make it public.
So you can just click on the OSH link and put your credit card in and get 6 boards?
You get 3 boards for $5. Actually, this is three boards for $6.60 shipped.
Great.
Yeah. Because it's only 0.88 by 1.25 or something like that. They charge $5 a square inch.
So what would your estimate be of how hard it is to build one, to assemble one of these?
I would say it's above the you know, the very easy, but it's not quite intermediate, because most of the stuff you're soldering, I specifically chose 0805 parts, so they're not hard to handle.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that got small was the SOT 23 5-pin and 6-pin. One's a voltage regulator and one's an op amp.
Now, what would be really cool is to commission a student to make a video assembling one of these.
Yeah.
That's an idea.
That's a great idea.
The technique of the little bitty guy soldering the one side down at a time, and then...
Especially since I've got a microscope with a video camera on it.
Ooh.
That'd be really nice. That'd be great.
That's all you need to build one of these. It's a microscope with a camera on it.
Right. What's the deal? I hear you loud and clear, Bill. That's what behind me is.
That microscope. I need
Yeah. We'll have to do some talking about this, but I'll do some logistics and we'll talk about this again.
That sounds really good. I like
it's doable, and it's not. I don't want to dive too deep into it because I don't want to get too far off track. But
no,
at this point, I'm the only one who can drive this, so I have to do it.
Yeah, and I'm just afraid that if we don't do something, like people are going to keep coming to us, and we're going to get. So, yeah, I think we have to have some way of handling this.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah,
if we want to be considered legit.
And
yeah,
you use the magnetometer you use on your board, right? How do you do the magnetometer for the
magnetometer's on Gen 2?
Okay, no, okay, good.
Yeah,
this yeah,
is just a single channel WWV beacon receiver. It was my concept prototype, and unfortunately, it worked too well.
This is the one you showed off at DCC like 2 years ago, right?
Uh huh.
Okay.
Yeah. I have one sitting under my desk here, you know, running.
You produce a miracle, John, then miracles are expected.
I know. Been there, done that.
Yeah.
Now, another difficult, prickly question for you, John.
You break it up. I can't hear you.
you can say no, but... So the question has arisen, and Jim Farmer has brought this up, that if we send one of these things to Antarctica, there are lots and lots of stations around the world that are on the same frequencies as WWV and WWVH. And one of the ways to disambiguate them is by looking at basically the full spectrum of WWV / or whatever. So I think it's like 8 kilohertz or something like that, 3 kilohertz. Anyway, whatever it is. But I understand that you currently have a 1.6 kilohertz bandpass filter.
Correct.
Is it possible to widen that for the two that are going down to Antarctica?
Sure.
Okay.
Definitely doable.
That would be...
Because I'm limiting it from 160 hertz to 1.6 kilohertz.
Mm-hmm.
That's my bandpass, and I got a couple of them in there.
So it is possible to widen that. So
yeah, just that spark value change.
Okay. That might be one good way of mitigating the problem of what you're listening to down there.
Okay.
Okay.
But I'll have to get the receiver back from Christina to modify it, but I've got the other one here so I can modify this one, make sure it works and swap them.
Okay.
So
that sounds good. And let's communicate.
But I'll need to know what you want for a bandpass.
Yeah, let's have a discussion with Christina and Steve Serwin. Steve Serwin is one of our experts on knowing what we need to see there.
So. But now that I've got the schematic up, I've actually got the schematic where everything is labeled, all the bandpass filters, all the bandpasses and the frequencies, they're all in the schematic. So you can look at it and figure out what's going on.
That's awesome.
So it's set up to be, you know, you look at it, you understand it. There's no mysteries about it.
Yeah.
So I'm going to try to make it foolproof.
Where do you have that posted, John?
What's that?
Where do you have that posted?
It's on the PSWS documentation on GitHub.
The Tangerine SDR's website?
No, not the Tangerine. It's the other one. HamSci.
HamSci one.
Oh, HamSci.
Mm-hmm.
GitHub.
Maybe I should make sure that is linked from the HamSci website to.
Maybe I should pop it in there myself. So. It's a race who can find it first. I think I'm going to lose.
By the way, while there's a null here, Jonathan, you will be able to set the VCC IO for the clock to whatever you want between 1.8 and 3.3. So since you have your own private clock from the clock module and each output has its own VCC IO, you'll be able to set that yourself.
So, I found the got it. Link, John.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
that was easy.
Everyone.
AmpSci GitHub went right to it.
Scotty, that's going to be, I would set that in the Verilog then?
No, you're going to supply a voltage output on a pin that will then drive the clock buffer on the clock module directly.
Oh, even better. Okay, perfect. Perfect.
Okay. You could give me permission to share the screen. I can show the schematic real quick.
Go for it.
Oh, sure. By the way, you're showing the Grape Gen 1 receiver.
Oh, yeah. Seer?
Receiver?
What's there's receiver? A V missing in the...
R-E-C-E-I...
No, that... No, that, I'm saying on the GitHub.
Oh, okay. But this is a schematic here, if everybody can see it. This little guy right here is the itsy-bitsy protection diode. It actually can handle a 20 microsecond, 1 amp pulse. It's basically a 5 volt back-to-back Zener diode, so it plus or minus 5 volts clamps.
And you couldn't find a bigger package?
Not for the infra protection that had low capacitance. This only presents, this is the crummy version. It presents 2 puffs. The better version presents a half a puff.
Right.
The intent, the connector itself is like 4 or 5 puffs. So that's within the realm of possibilities, but there's your input filter. This is the power supply. This is the mixer section. This is where the Leo Bogart comes in and gets signal attenuated for the correct input for the mixer. And then you just have a simple differential op amp with some gain in the filters. And I got the gain points and the filter points all marked here for the high pass and the low pass filter, 3 dB points. And this entire thing off 12 volts pulls 7.2 milliamps.
Hmm.
And I'm embarrassed to say, I think 3 of that is running my blue LED.
Oh, no.
Gotta have some color.
So
can you make that public on OSH Park? Because some of us have all of the components needed to go ahead right away.
Okay. Actually, give me 2 seconds here.
You need some more tabs there, John.
Yeah. How do you keep track of those?
Let's
man, after my own heart.
Do, 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 do. There's a space here someplace to say how many. Oh, here it is. Let it reload. Do, do, do. This, by the way, might interest some people. This is an Anderson power pole that plugs into your power strip, and it's got one of those little digital voltmeters on it, so you can measure your voltage on your battery for your field day stuff. And that's a 4 version of it. That's a 7 version of it. No, come on, where are you?
WWV.
There it is there.
Look at that.
That should be easy to build.
See, and that I think that this would be really nice to have, because people are always asking, like I get a lot of people asking, you know, is there something we can build? Is there something we can do? And I'm just like,
of course,
as you can see, the price
that has the external uses an external oscillator or internal?
What's that?
Is that external or internal local oscillator?
The LO is the Leo Bodnar.
Okay.
Because
you realize, of course, that would work even better on, would work fine on CHU.
Oh, yeah. And that's already programmed into my system.
Yeah.
You can do CHU 3.33 and 7.85, as well as 14.67.
Mm-hmm.
spinning up.
Yeah, CHU is single sideband with carrier. I always listen to it on sideband.
Oh, okay.
It's quieter than...
That's the whole board.
Just make it public, it would be...
One not down. One down. You're on the analog.
Yep, I see that. blah blah blah. I'll have to figure this out, but yeah, I can make it public. Anyway, as you can tell, it's not going to be that much work.
That's really nice.
It's a weekend project.
Yeah.
That was a joke around OpenHPSDR. Phil would give us a project and say, I think, weren't the filters a weekend project?
Yeah, the ones that took 2 years?
Yes.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I've been on a few of those.
Now, I will point out the reason I was asking about Bodnar and what you're using there. I'm using... series that TI makes of programmable PLLs
mm-hmm.
that, well, in this case, there, I think you can do an external. I just program standalone, but I generate two frequencies to run the RTL-SDR system that we do. But those are pretty convenient little guys.
Yeah, actually, I had one originally designed into the Gen 2, but when John Ackerman came up with the ability to give me the frequency directly, I took the PLLs out.
Yeah.
So, but that's going to show up in my presentation in 3 weekends from now.
Yeah, this is the CDCE 900 series that okay. I used pretty effectively.
Yeah, I guess John Ackerman was worried about clock jitter or phase jitter or clock, you know, basically how much does it wiggle around when you generate.
Yeah,
right.
Well, as a generic, you know, for the full-blown system, we want to be very cognizant of that. But for this particular application, probably you don't need to be that clean.
You're probably right. So anyway.
I have a question for Scotty.
Fire away.
Are you there? Mm-hmm. With your DE, in the previous, the HPSDR radios, we did the Ethernet stuff in Verilog.
Right.
So on these boards that you're making, the DE boards, well, the development kit, it has like an Ethernet chip, right?
It has a PHY, yeah.
And is that what you have on the DE as well?
Yeah, we have basically a three-port Ethernet chip, and the port facing the FPGA looks like a PHY.
So is there a reason that we have to do everything in UDP?
Yeah, because we'd have to do the Mac layer we're going to have to do anyway. We're going to have to put a Mac in the FPGA fabric. And
okay.
We'll probably use one of the library
parts. Well, for all the signal stuff, UDP is fine, but it would be a lot easier to do the programming with the TCP link.
Yeah, so the problem is that TCP is a lot harder than UDP with our fake ACK on the top of
it. So, I mean, I can do it either way, but I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, well, is that already there? Or...
It's not, so that's...
Okay, there. That solves my question. The other question is, I've been trying to think about this extended packet and how to structure it and variations. So I've got two examples of old protocols, and I know we're going to have a new protocol, and we're going to want to be able to swap in descriptors of the different boards and different uses. So it may be a same board, but we might have a different FPGA code for special uses.
Right. Well, but the response will be governed by the FPGA program, so it'll look like a different piece of hardware anyway, even if it isn't.
Well, right. But what I'm trying to think about is structuring the packet so that it's able to do it. And what I'm thinking of doing is building basically a structure that has the details of that particular piece, and then we'll just have an ID number in the discovery packet that tells you what part of the structure you're using in this particular radio.
Okay, so when you say, I'm thinking this is going to be part of discovery, isn't it? Or is this going to be?
But yes, in discovery. Now, discovery is different than, there should be a discovery once radio's working, but then there's another discovery of when there is limited or no other code there. I mean, there will be the bootloader.
If the bootloader's in charge.
Yes, but there will also be a discovery that's a bit different for once the radio's installed.
Okay, because I'm figuring that once the radio is installed, you're still going to be able to request boot mode, because you're going to have to get into boot mode, which will to invoke the boot. You're going to have to invoke the bootloader in order to reprogram the part.
Yes. Right now we use the bootloader for two purposes. And what I'm saying is we might want to separate those two purposes. So I have a bootloader discovery that has the capability of putting firmware into the FPGA. And the other one would be the radio's capability discovery. And that's dependent on both the hardware and the software of the particular RF board.
So what would happen is when you booted the radio, turned it on, it would boot into the bootloader / discovery portion of the FPGA. And then when you wanted to operate, say you're good with the program that's loaded in it, then when you hit basically the run bit, then it would reprogram the FPGA, and then you would get the...
Well, we wouldn't reprogram the FPGA, in the way you're thinking about it, yes, we're reprogramming.
You reload the RAM.
We're reloading the flash.
Reloading the RAM.
RAM, yes.
Yeah, because the flash... So you'd go to the other flash image.
Right.
But the point being is that when you turn the radio on, you always go to the boot image, the known boot image.
The other thing that I'm worried about is the bootloader doesn't need much space. It's small. Right. So we're allocating an awful lot of memory to that.
Well, you can thank Intel for that, not allowing us to share it with memory initialization. So, but you know, the other thing that we can do is we could build ourselves a small bootloader that was part of the radio for a month, and we could copy it into the other side as a bootloader.
It could be on both sides,
it would have to be, because if you munge one side because something happened, you have to be able to get at the other side that's known good, that's never overwritten.
Yes, and the bootloader should be in the same address space on both sides.
But what I'm thinking is you could put the bootloader in the real bootloader that talks UDP. You could put that in local flash memory, external flash memory, external to the FPGA, on the board, but not inside the FPGA. And then our bootloader would actually just consist of a small routine to copy that.
Right.
And execute out of it. Because if you're going to, so I'll have to think about this a little bit more. But the thing about it is that, yes, the bootloader is small, and yes, you're wasting most of the size of the FPGA, but so what? You're not running the radio, so it doesn't make any difference what you're doing. It does seem like a waste.
Well, when we're running the radio, we want to use as much of that as we can.
Right, but you can still only use the full complement of what gets loaded in the RAM.
Right.
You can never get any more than that. However, depending on how we would structure it, it might be that there would be you can't really do that. I was going to say there'd be routines that reside in one image that wouldn't be in the other.
Yeah.
But you can't just arbitrarily go back and forth between images. So
I was thinking that you'd have a bootloader, and then you'd have a piece of RF code, and you're going to have to have some clock code somewhere. Unless it does, it have its own. You got rid of the other FPGA, so whatever it needs to understand
whatever the clock module comes up with on its own. We don't have an FPGA there, so.
So you just need to be able to read the pins.
Well, we would talk to the clock module via I2C,
right,
and program it to whatever we wanted, but what you want is stored in the FPGA image.
Okay.
Right, because, but what we can do is, what I'm thinking is that what's going to be in the FPGA image is going to be a NEOS processor.
Right.
And so what I want is code space. I want code space for that processor.
Okay.
And that's why we provided the external RAM.
Okay.
So we have codes, external RAM and ROM, so we can boot up, we can put the NEOS code, copy it from flash into RAM, and then we can run out of RAM, and we have a huge big RAM, so we'll have enough room for all of the code space, and then we'll have extra RAM for buffering packets and, you know, whatever else we need to do.
Okay.
And I guess we'll find out how much RAM we need as we go along.
I'm basically rebuilding what I already know, so that by the time we get to you, we can figure out what's different.
If I could interrupt before everybody disappears.
Yes.
I'm going to share my screen again. It looks like I've got the project shared. I put the link in the chat, and your guys' homework assignment is to see if you can go and try and order the board. And the other thing I wanted to show you is this is a SOT23 5 pin. This is a SOT23 5 pin. Those are the two fine pitch parts. This is the 8 pin standard 50,000 spacing chip. This is the diode I'm talking about that's itsy bitsy. You see, this is an 0805 resistor. It's smaller than the size of one of the pads. But the trick to soldering this is you put a blob of solder on, you get it hot, you slide the part in so it grabs the one pin, then you just blob the other one, you're done.
So are two of those pins connected together on that diode? This is obviously only two pins. Is one a no connect?
Yeah, one's a no connect. This one right here is a no connect.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so but it's actually a center tap, isn't it?
No.
It's not connected?
It's just the diode is from pin one to pin two, and pin three is unused.
So if I blob the solder from one to three, it won't make it not work then.
Yeah, nope. It'll increase the capacitance a little bit, but who cares?
Yeah, a lot of times they make the package polarized like that so that if you have a unipolar part, it can't be installed wrong.
Right. Well, this is a back-to-back Zener, so it really doesn't matter which way you put it in, but it is, that's the smallest part on the board. But anyway, can anybody see the or try the link? I guess this, Dave Witten, this is a homework assignment for you. Can you get to my link and order the board?
Dave is well practiced with OSH part.
Yeah, I've done a few orders there myself. I love it when they upgrade you to the premium service for free, because then you get it in like a week.
Yeah, I just clicked it and it gave me an order option.
Excellent, excellent. So I guess I did share it right then.
Yeah.
I will work on getting a parts list called WWV Radio version 1.11 up on DigiKey, and some little blurb right up for Nathaniel to review.
That sounds great, John.
John, I have it ordered already. So
look at that.
You
get three boards now, so you get three shots at it.
Sure. Well, I'd like to have some backups.
Say, Dave, can I have one of those boards?
if I don't destroy them all.
Yeah. John, what did you say the link for the DigiKey bomb will be?
It right now is up on the PSWS. It's called, let me share the screen again.
There could be a way for you to put that link up as a public link and we can all just click on it.
See, it's under the PSWS documentation. You go under Grape Gen 1, and then the WWV radio is all my Eagle files, and this parts.bom. There's the parts list. quantity, what the part is, the size of the package, what the part designation is, and what the DigiKey part number is.
Oh, yeah.
But this is not a DigiKey. I mean,
this is GitHub, Scotty. This is
GitHub, so.
So what I have to do is just put all these in and make whatever that parts list that would be available. So I'll talk to you, Scotty, on how to do that.
Okay.
I've done the hard work. All the part numbers are there. It's just putting them in one place, calling it something that everybody can access.
Yeah. Sounds like a half hour's worth of work. You got all the part numbers.
Yeah.
So
I even included the jumper that you plug on the pins.
Yep.
Which I forgot the first time. Anyway.
That looks great.
Actually, let me go ahead and pop that into the chat. Oh, come on, go back. There. That is the parts bomb in the chat window there.
Not hard to find.
So are there really like, I'm thinking like two levels of bill of materials. One is to build the board, obviously. And the second is to build the system, the Pi, the Bodnar, the core, right. The this, that.
That's what I got to work on next. Because you basically buy a Raspberry Pi 4, the case for it, which has the fan. I also have to provide the image that has the modified FL Digi that comes up and runs and all that stuff. You have to buy the Leo Bodnar. You have to buy some cables to tie the Bodnar to the board and a SO239 to SMA connector to tie the antenna to the my radio receiver. It's all that little logistics stuff. So that's...
And then there's a software to get the right version of FL Digi, though maybe your image contains all that. I don't know.
My image contains everything and it auto boots, and it's the image that's running in the field now. Also has the personal space weather station setup program, so you can enter in all the space information, your node number, and all that kind of stuff. It's all there. This is the image that I ship now. So,
and it's on an SD card?
Yep. I squished the image down to 12 gig from 32 gig. So it's not going to fit up on GitHub because GitHub throws up on anything over, I think, 10 gig. We'll have to figure that out too. So there's some logistics we have to work out, but I have to get a parts list of all the cables and the Pi and the SD card and all that kind of stuff. So got more work to do, but I've got the hard stuff, I think, done. I think. Famous last words. 20 hours later.
Yeah, when you first try to build it and you find that, oops.
Yeah, the oops factor.
You know, I think I have an almost identical radio that Ramsey made that uses the 612 or the 602, one of the other.
Yeah, one thing on Jay Silber's presentation he made on the YouTube, he described what we're doing technically a little bit wrong because he referred to the 1 kilohertz signal that's coming from WWV constantly, which is not correct.
Right.
We're really doing
upper. There's another mistake too. He said that when the sun pushes, sun comes on the ionosphere rises.
Yeah.
No. So anyway, don't listen too closely to that.
Yeah. There's a couple of things. Maybe on the presentation, I'll give a quick theory of operation for the Gen 2 stuff to sort of cover that again. And why we're not using lower sideband for the frequency inversion. So. Anyway, I'm going to have to get running here, guys. I think I've got everybody's questions covered. If not, please email me. I'm back finally again. So
you haven't made any changes to the pinout, right?
No, the one I emailed you with the Raspberry Pi, that is the one that's in the schematic right now.
Okay, that's the one that I make sure I cover. So we got to just touch base again once before we...
But I need to touch base with you on the pinout for John Ackerman's board to make sure we've got all the pins.
Oh, great.
He's got to give me two serial lines to talk to the GPS unit, which he says he can do.
We already do that. Yeah, I mean that'll be the baseboard that he.
I have to be able to turn my board, the Raspberry Pi, into a Stratum 1 clock reference.
So are you going to take the clock module that we use on the data on the Tangerine and just plug it onto your board?
Is that suspect that's what we're going to do, yeah.
Because we have lots of extra I.O. on that connector that the data engine doesn't use.
Okay. So
put it on there, hopefully for you and for John's carrier board that he wants to make. So, but now it would be a good time to check that because...
Yeah, that would be a good idea. So, yeah, it sounds like I'm coming in at the right time to ask those questions. So,
yeah, because actually within the next week or so, we're going to be nailing this down. And then after that, there's not going to be able
it's to... not going to be able to change it. Yeah, I get that. So... okay, I will be in touch, Scotty.
Okay, sounds good.
Does anybody else have anything else for me? I think I've caused enough trouble for one night, so I will say 73s.
73.
Everybody stay healthy.
At least the Nathaniel looks warmer now without his coat on.
I'm still in Alaska here with this White Alice radio system behind
me. Turn the transmitter on. That'll warm you right in.
Yeah. You know, at some point I saw this advertisement. It was like an old time advertisement for a GE microwave heater that they advertised. Geez. I've been trying to find that advertisement, but I cannot find it anywhere on the internet. But they marketed this radio heater that you could put in your living room. And you could point it at someone and it would heat you up.
Warm them up.
Oh, that sounds like a great idea.
I don't know what happened to it. Why did it not?
It probably got sued out of existence.
Yes.
Like the grandma's in the shoe stores.
Instant cataracts.
Cancer and deformities. And I think it's your heater that's killed us.
Grandma didn't used to have a third eye on her forehead.
Hey, you know, when I was on board the ship, they would tell me about guys who would go out and work on the radars, and they would warm their hands on the radar units that were running while they were working on the ones that weren't operating.
I heard of a guy melting a chocolate bar in his pocket when he accidentally stepped in front of it.
Yeah. These guys were doing it on purpose, though. And I mean, you're technical guys that should have known better.
Yeah.
Not to put your hand in front of the radar. It's like,
oof. Well. On that note, I'll leave you guys alone. Take care, 73s.
73.
How many people have their vaccines?
I have half.
I got the first one, and I regret it.
Yeah, I got the first one also.
I got one. Getting second in a couple of weeks.
I'll get the second one in spite of what happened after the first one.
Yeah.
Which one did you get, Scotty? Moderna or Pfizer?
Pfizer, and it was, I thought it was a bad reaction, but going online and reading, it turns out it's about a normal reaction, I think. It was 2 days of aches and pains and fever and not feeling good.
You had some immunity already, but
I did.
My wife had both doses of Pfizer and didn't even notice it, you know, at all. And my mother's had both Modernas, thankfully, at 92, and has had no problem whatsoever either there.
Well, it depends on the person. I'm having a Moderna. My arm was sore, but other than that, that was okay. But I'm told that the second shot can be more of a reaction.
Yeah.
A lot of people have said that, but I didn't have any real reaction to the first or second on Moderna. Mm-hmm. That's been 3 weeks ago. So
Bill, did they ever tell you whether you got a placebo or not?
Well, I was in the clinical study back in the fall, and then first week of this year, university contacted me, said, "Hey, we want you to be part of our test group." Okay, right. So I called Moderna and said, "You got to unblind me so I know whether I need this other shot." And said, so they did. And they said, "Okay, you got the placebo during the fall." So I told the university, "Okay, I'll go and do your shots. And they gave me the Moderna too. So I'm still part of both studies since it was both Moderna. Mm-hmm. So we'll see. But I didn't have a lot of reaction to it. I mean, other than the same soreness you get from a flu shot.
Yeah, I had the sore arm too, but that wasn't the big part of it was just the feeling bad for 2 days.
Right.
It took almost 24 hours for the symptoms to appear, which is interesting.
Interesting.
Yeah, I've heard that. 2 or 3 days, it can be up to a week.
Wow, okay.
Yep. Well, my attitude is like my attitude towards getting old. It beats the alternative.
By far.
By the way, I found the Ramsey kit that I was talking about. That's the schematic. I don't know if you can see it. It's almost identical.
What's that for?
This is actually a single band receiver kit. What do they call it when you... there's a word for it where you're... it's direct conversion receiver.
I think I'm going to sign off and say 73 for okay. Now. I've got to go put together lists of people's emails to send to the iPoster company so they can get people starting making iPosters.
And so. Nathaniel, I'll send you a synopsis tomorrow. So.
Okay, that sounds really good. Yeah, because I'm going to start building out the... I've got to get that schedule up on the website by the end of this week. So that we can start advertising it and people know that what they want to come here.
I got to sign up too. Nathaniel, I'll maybe talk to you tomorrow.
That sounds, yeah, that'll be fine. I think tomorrow's okay. A good day for...
I'll let you know.
Okay, yeah.
All right, I got to sign up too.
Okay. Let me sign off. I'm going to go check the magnetometers.
I'm going to go TRT also. Good night, all.
You come. It's
73.
I'm going to leave Scotty in charge.
Good night, folks.
I've got comment about the Leo Bodnar, and I've got some pretty good frequency measuring stuff here. And the it's really important to have the latest firmware in the two-channel device. The older firmware, its frequency just jumped around like a cricket.
Yikes. And
much, much better in the with the latest version 1.15.
Yeah, I had one, but it got left behind in South Africa. We had an experiment down there. So I don't have one to test right now. But I think he uses the Silicon Labs synthesizer in there.
He uses a LEAM8T, right? I think.
Yeah, that doesn't sound familiar.
Does that sound right?
That's the U-Blox.
That's the U-Blox one. You're right.
Oh, that's the GPS side of it.
GPS side.
But then he feeds it into a, I believe, a Silicon Labs. At least this was a few years ago. He may have changed that. But everybody's using the Silicon Labs.
It's interesting because John Ackerman's working on the FOC module, and he refuses to get a Leo Bodnar because he doesn't want to be accused of reverse engineering it and putting
right.
it in our module. So he won't even open it. He won't get one. He won't open it up. He doesn't want to hear what's inside.
There's no real reason to. It's pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
I've opened it up. Yeah, I'd asked Leo if he had actually any thoughts of putting a ovenized oscillator in there instead of the TCXO that he uses. Because we wanted better holdover characteristics. Said no, he's not going to bother.
Yeah. Well, we can get pretty good performance with TCXO, which is what we're going to use on the.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that it works fine as long as you got satellites in view. But I've noticed a lot of satellite dropouts. You know, the constellation gets in a place where you're not getting a clear view of them. Especially with sites that have a lot of trees. So,
oh, yes.
A few seconds of holdover, you will be no problem with. But if you want...
Yeah, it could be minutes.
...longer, then that's not going to be good.
Yeah. So that's why I pushed on John to give us some options.
Yeah, and we're building it with three options of GPSs, although the low-cost GPS... for some reason is not going to give us the one PPS output, because it's like the Leo Bodner with one output. You only get
right, one. It does one or the other. Yeah.
So if you have 10 megahertz, which you kind of need, then you don't get one PPS. So that kind of relegates us to the only two options, really.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is $190 and the other one is $50.
Yeah.
So,
$190 is the L1, L2 one?
Yes, the dual frequency one.
Yep, dual frequency.
Yeah. So that'll probably be what we'll focus on. And we may have the lower cost one just because $150 is a lot of difference in price.
Right,
we'll probably have the cost of the, or a little, not quite half maybe, but it'll reduce the cost significantly. So, well, we did get a BOM cost for the data engine. I got that yesterday in single quantities, or actually in the prototype quantities that we're going to build first, about $145 BOM cost, which is a little bit higher than I wanted. But when we had to go to the fastest speed grade of FPGA, they made me use an industrial temperature. Are you leaving, Dave?
I'm leaving.
Okay.
Because I noticed it's getting late.
Yeah.
People upstairs are wondering what happened to me.
We all know what happened to me.
Yeah.
Anyway, so
73.
It's about $140, which is about $40 more than I wanted it to be. But when I had to go to that FPGA, that raised the price about $23, something like that, $20.
Why did you have to go to the highest
speed? Well, I wanted to go to, because to do gigabit Ethernet, I really need the six speed grade, the fastest speed grade.
Huh.
And it would probably work most of the time with the lower speed grade, but that I don't really like probably sometimes, maybe. I would rather have it be guaranteed, meet timing.
And that's actually interesting that the industrial grade is the higher speed.
Yeah, and that's what I thought, because typically industrial grade is the next lower speed grade.
Right.
It has to operate over a wider temperature,
yeah.
So it'll guarantee the timing.
CMOS slows down when you heat it up.
But if you look at the MAX 10 board from Terrasic that has dual gigabit Ethernet ports on it, like we have gigabit Ethernet also. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to make sure it would work. And I figured out that this is why he has a C6, but he has a C6 ES, which is an engineering sample on his board. So I called up our local rep and we're negotiating this, right? Cause I get a good price for this stuff, and we're negotiating the price, but he says, my book doesn't even have the C6 ES in it. So I can't quote you a price on it because I can't get it. And at first he says, I don't even have anything in the six speed grade, nothing. Mm. And I go, well, you can't tell me that. So he goes off and investigates, and Intel comes back and says, oh yeah, you can get a -6, but you got to buy an I6 to get the -6. And each speed grade is between a 10 and 15% increase in price.
Right.
And we went from an 8 to a 6, that's two jumps in speed grade. And every jump in temperature, which we went just one jump in temperature from C to I, that's another 10 to 15%. So we've got like three jumps of 10 to 15% in between what we originally spec'd and what the part we actually have to use. So
how much does the next grade down cost?
Well, it depends on where you go to buy it.
Yeah.
Because we get a price that I'm really not at liberty to let.
Yeah,
to,
I understand. Well, maybe I should just ask how much less does it cost?
It's 10%.
10% less.
10% between the speed grades and 10% between the I and the C.
I'm wondering if we wanted to populate one of the boards once we have it available with the next grade down and then put it in a temperature chamber and see where it craps out.
Yeah, yeah.
And it might be fine for commercial, consumer temperature range.
because the tool will actually measure the performance or calculate the performance, compensating for voltage and temperature. And you get to pick the thresholds. If you want to pick a threshold that's lower than their normal C range, you can do that, and it will test, it will calculate the point, the data points at wherever you set them. And so I just leave them set at, you know, 0 and 70, and figuring it's never going to get to 70. So if it's sitting on my desk as a demo board, then if I get the timing within 10%, it's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen timing within 20% that still works at room temperature.
Right.
So, you know, but in a product, I think that's bad form to ship things that don't run over the full temperature range of the device. So that's why the i6. It's
Well, I've done a fair amount of threading the needle like that.
Yeah. But I mean, there's certainly people who, if they want to make a,
because you know, usually you're not going to be in an environment that's above 50 C, for sure.
Yeah. So I mean, we could set the limits a little slower and see if.
Of course, you're in Arizona. You might.
Well, when you put the controller at the top of your tower,
yeah,
it's going to be hot.
Yeah, and you have to account for the package temperature, of course. But I'm just saying. No, you might get to 122F over there, but.
Yes, in the black box at the top of the tower in the sun with no fan.
I've seen 112 air temperature. In Boise a couple of years ago.
And my truck closed with the windows closed in the summer. I have a thermometer in there. It's above 140.
Yeah.
In the truck, in the air temperature. So. And in fact, actually on HPSTR, I remember a guy, he was running it mobile and he was running it in the summer and he was just setting it on the seat of his car. And he could actually get the thing to crap out with over temperature at high temperature. Mm. Get the thing to start, you could hear it start missing packets and it. High temperature is not good.
No.
Antarctica, much better.
Yep, I'll take it.
Okay.
Actually, the coldest I've experienced was not Antarctica. It was in Alaska in January.
Yeah, well, needless to say, we don't get very many cold days in Arizona.
Yeah.
A cold day is when it gets below 90.
Okay.
A cold day is when you think, do I want to wear shorts? And you say, nah.
Yeah. Well, my story of hot and cold is when I went to the Bay Area for Christmas, where I had two brothers in the area at that time. And it's 80 degrees during the day, and they're complaining about it being too hot. And it was 70 degrees in the evening. They were complaining it was too cold.
70 is too cold?
Yeah. Wow. Of course, it was dry, but still.
Yeah.
That was funny. Well,
I know that when I want to go out and ride on my bicycle and it's winter time, and I usually like to ride in the evenings or at nighttime because it's the less congested time on the bike trails and all that. And I go and I say, oh, it's 55. That's too cold. I don't want to go out and ride. What a wuss.
Yep.
55.
Well, we have people riding their bikes in the snow around here.
Yeah, I know. My buddy Mike is from Minnesota, and he's always giving me a hard time about how, well, you know, you got to ride when it's 0 degrees or, you know, 25 below. Well, I went and visited him one time, and it was just below freezing, you know, maybe 25 degrees. And mm-hmm. He's saying, oh, it's too cold to go outside and ride. I go, well, wait a minute. You know, what happened to this, you know, minus 20 rides kind of stuff? And you know, getting your fat tire bike out and riding in the snow. He's like, oh, well, yeah, you can do it, but you have to bundle all up and it's a big pain in the neck. And then, you know, blah, 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 blah. So he's doesn't want to do it. So I see how it is, you know.
Yep.
Just like we don't go out when it's, well, I still go out when it's over 110. And so somebody, I have a radio on my bike, so I'm talking on the radio and I'm out cruising. And the first day we had above 110 degree temperature, and it's still 110 at, you know, 8 o'clock at night. And they're going like, wow, you're crazy. You know, it's so hot out there. How can you stand this? And I go, there's no sun on me. I got a 15 mile an hour breeze. The relative humidity is 2%.
Right.
I'm comfortable. I have no problem.
Yeah. You got to dress for the wind chill.
That's right. And you know, when I go out, I take a bottle of water and a bottle of Gatorade. The Gatorade is to drink to rehydrate, and the water is to dump on my face to wash the salt off so it doesn't get in my eyes. So,
very good.
The adaptation you have to do, you know?
Yep.
So, Bob, are you still there? Bob is here.
He's in limbo. Well, I got 73. Good to talk to you all.
73, David. Good talking to you.
Hope my lights stay on. They've been blinking. We've got strong winds coming through. As I mentioned, it was pushing 40 today, and it's going to go into the single numbers overnight.
Shades of Texas.
Yep, something like that. But it's fairly normal here. We get these strong fronts.
Hope you got lots of blankets.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
73.
Yep, 73 all.